Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two segments today. We'll hear from a public defender about the profound injustices caused by sex offender registries. And then a Chilean activist will tell us about that country's referendum to rewrite its constitution, a move that is properly read as a rejection of the neoliberalism imposed on the country under General Augusto Pinochet. Before that, a correction of something Paul Street said in last week's interview about Obama. Paul said Obama's presidential library will be the first run by a private foundation and not by the National Archives, and that there would be no archivists on the site. A professional archivist wrote me to explain that neither of these things is true. There are archivists working at the Obama Library, and while a portion of the library will be run by Obama's foundation, the records from his presidency will be available to researchers, as with other presidential libraries. A word about the massive GDP number released on Thursday morning. The headline number was breathtaking, a gain of 33% at an annualized rate. That's a record, and by a lot. But the number needs some context. First, annualized. The U.S. is alone among rich countries in not expressing quarterly changes in pure percentage terms. Instead, we express that quarterly change as if the rate were extended through a full year, so that 33% figure is actually 7.4% annualized. And despite that rise, we're still 3.5% below where we were at the end of last year, a deficiency that itself would qualify as a deep recession. And as I pointed out before, we never fully recovered from the 2008-2009 downturn. Had the growth rate that prevailed between 1970 and 2007 continued since, GDP would be 28% higher than it is, or almost $14,000 per person. Yes, GDP is a very flawed measure, and given the way the rich have claimed almost all the proceeds of economic growth for several decades, that certainly doesn't mean that each of us would be $14,000 richer. But GDP is a measure of the resources available to us under capitalism, and is also the preferred measure of mainstream sorts. So far from being the best economy ever, as Trump likes to claim of his pre-COVID record, by this very conventional measure, U.S. capitalism is failing badly. Enough of me. Here's a topic that's a bit off the beaten track for the show, sex offender registries. Mandated by federal law, these are lists of people, searchable by name or locality on the web, who've committed what are called sex crimes, though as we'll hear, the truth is more complicated than that. People can stay on the list for life well after they've served their sentence. They're an outrage against justice. Here's Kat Pecor, a public defender in New York City, to explain why. So let's start with the basics. Sex offender registries, what are they? When do they start? Where'd they come from?
It all started in the 80s and 90s. There was a handful of kind of truly horrific incidents where young children were kidnapped, sexually assaulted, and murdered by strangers. We now know that those types of offenses are and always have been extraordinarily rare. But, you know, at the time, we were in the middle of the tough on crime movement, the 90s, the victims' rights movement. And the media sort of treated this as if there was an epidemic of stranger child molestation and created a lot of public hysteria. And as a result, Congress enacted a series of federal statutes requiring the states to implement registries.
The states have no choice in this.
It's correct. In order to receive federal funding, they have to have registries, and there's a certain baseline they have to meet in terms of notification requirements and registration requirements. So the states can be more punitive than the federal standard, which is SORNA, Sex Offender Registration Notification Act. The federal law states can be more restrictive, but they can't be less restrictive. So these registries just grew and grew and became more and more punitive over time. And as a result, we now have, in New York, it's SORA, Sex Offender Registration Act. And these laws were named after the children who were the victims in these highly publicized offenses. So you've probably heard Megan's Law. There's the Jacob Wetterling Act, the Adam Walsh Act. They're all named after these child victims. And in general, what I've learned as an attorney is that when you have a law named after a victim, especially a child victim, that law is going to have massively unintended consequences in its application because those are by definition extreme outlier cases. So it's gone well untethered from the original intent of these laws.
So now how many people are on these things?
The latest figure that I'm certain of is in 2016, there were 859,500 people on state and federal registries in the United States. Now that number is actually closer to 900,000, maybe even higher. So we're approaching a million. In New York, as of 2016, there were 39,000. And that number has grown, you know, exponentially in the last decade since SORNA, federal SORNA, was enacted.
That's an enormous number.
It is. We think of it as the worst of the worst, but if it's close to a million people, how could that possibly be true?
Well, I'm sure some people would say there is an epidemic of child sexual abuse and such, and this is just a reasonable response to a very serious problem. What do you say to that?
Well, it's a very serious problem, and we know that sexual harm is pervasive in our society. But the reality is that currently, most people who commit sexual harm face no accountability whatsoever. They're never caught. They're not punished. The ones who are caught and punished in our criminal punishment system essentially receive a life sentence, a stigma that follows them everywhere. So they're not being rehabilitated. They're being punished for the rest of their lives. It's hard to understand how that could deter people from committing sexual harm. It just doesn't work. And the social science teaches us that these registries actually have no correlation to reducing recidivism.
I'm sure a lot of people think that these sex criminals are incorrigibly recidivistic. Is that not true?
It's absolutely true. That is the common misperception. There is a notion that they are uniquely dangerous, sick in the head, people who will just go on to prey on children again and again, when in fact, the studies show us that recidivism for sexual offenses is lower than for any other category of crime, I believe, except homicide. The figures vary, but it is always well below 5% recidivism rate, and that is the FBI's own crime data confirms that. So it's a very, very low number. Not to mention, most sex crimes are committed by people who are not on the registry. They are committed by first-time offenders. There's absolutely nothing that the registry does that keeps our children safe.
Now, the paranoia originated around stranger crime, but how many of these crimes are committed by actual strangers?
Very few. So the reason why we hear about these cases is because they're so anomalous. For child sexual assaults, which are kind of the target of these laws, 93% of those are committed by someone the victim knows. So it's usually a family member, a friend, a teacher, a pastor, whatever. So the idea that we're somehow identifying strangers in the community who are going to pop out of the bushes and attack our children out of the blue, I mean, it's just based on a fiction.
If we're talking numbers approaching a million, the kinds of crimes that get people on these lists are not sodomizing children or raping women at knife point. What does it take to get on one of these lists?
It depends on the state. You know, every state has different crimes that are registrable, but it's everything from the truly horrific, like we've already discussed, to the totally mundane. So a lot of times it is rape or sexual assault by an acquaintance or an intimate partner. It could be public lewdness, urination, exhibitionism, groping someone's butt on the subway. In New York, that's a misdemeanor, but if you do it twice, you get on the registry. Teenagers sexting back and forth, they can get child porn charges and trafficking charges, a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old. Even crimes that are violent in nature, like assault, that don't have a sexual component, like let's say you rob someone and you accidentally touch their private areas in the process, that can get you on the registry. I've seen that. Or abducting your own child, you know, in a custody battle with no sexual motivation whatsoever. Those people are also on the registry. And so there's no consistency or logic to it whatsoever.
So what are the consequences of being on the registry? What's the typical burden?
It's very onerous. It is effectively a life sentence. So most people stay on the registry for decades or for life. I've personally never heard of anybody successfully coming off, although I know it does happen. Everywhere you go, you're identified as the offense first and not as the person that you are. There are notification requirements. Your private information can be shared by law enforcement with vulnerable entities like schools and nursing homes, daycares. Your information is on the internet for everyone to look up. Your photo, your physical characteristics, your residence, your work address, the car you drive, almost everything imaginable that would allow people to target you and your family for vigilante violence, which happens quite a bit. You have to report every few months or few years in person to the police precinct. Every time you have a new email address or you enroll in a new school program, you have to report that. Online usernames, you have to report that. And it's even worse if you're on supervision. You probably won't be able to use the internet if you're on supervision for a sex offense. You might actually have to tell a sexual partner in front of your parole officer that you were convicted of a sexual offense and get the approval to begin that relationship. So it's totally humiliating. Every part of your life is dominated by something that you did maybe years or decades ago.
I was really surprised when I looked up my zip code in the New York State Registry and found something like 30 or 40 names. Now, some of them were duplicates because people had aliases and all the aliases are also listed, but that's an enormously large number for people who just live in my neighborhood. I mean, this is, I guess, typical of what you could find around the country.
Yes, I would say so. I think there are, the registries have grown in size such that there's no longer any real correlation to the risk that anyone poses. And I think that if the registry is designed to sort of ferret out and identify people who are a danger to society, when everybody's on the registry, it's no longer doing that.
Just my casual inspection of the registry listed for my zip code, almost every perp seemed to be Black. Is that a fair perception of the demographics?
Yes, absolutely. The demographic spread that I see in my work for sex offenses is very similar to the demographic spread that I see for other types of offenses that I work with. Overwhelmingly, we are looking at usually Black people, usually men of color who are poor. A lot of them have mental health issues. A lot of them have disabilities, and they're uniquely vulnerable to being targeted. So they're really bearing the brunt of these punitive policies, whereas the people in positions of power tend to very much get away with it. So it is a very racist system in its implementation. Absolutely.
So what are the consequences for people's lives? Is it hard to get a place to live, get a job, get into a school?
Absolutely. One of the biggest problems is residency restrictions. So about 30 states, I believe, have residency restrictions, which usually means you can't live within 1,000 or 2,000 feet of a school, daycare, places where children congregate, however that's defined in the law. So one of the most perverse things is that in New York, anybody who's a level 3, so that's the highest risk tier on the registry, or has a conviction for an offense against a minor, while they are on parole or supervision, they can't live within 1,000 feet of a school. And this is defined as the borderline of the school grounds. So as you can imagine, given the density of the 5 boroughs, that's almost everywhere that they can't live. So what that effectively means is people who are coming out of prison, who got parole granted, they actually are held in past their release date. They lose their good time credit. They are held to their max date. And then they get on a wait list, essentially, for a bed in the shelter system. There are something like 8 beds a month available for people convicted of sex offenses. So there's a huge backlog. And if you don't want to do that, then you have to essentially, from prison, figure out how to locate private housing without actually knowing the neighborhoods that are safe. They don't tell you where to look. The algorithm that they use to determine distance is proprietary. They do not share it with people. They do not share it with attorneys. And as a result, a lot of my clients have been held in prison 9 months to a year now after their max release dates. And if they have a lifetime parole, the prison's position is that they can hold them forever because parole is a privilege and not a right. So we are incarcerating people long past their release dates because of the residency restrictions in New York.
And the underlying philosophy of this is something that's really pervasive in American law, that someone just doesn't commit a crime, but there's some, in some sense, essentially a criminal, which curiously is something we share with Nazi law. Is that what's at play here? Like three strikes law, same idea that you're just a fatally flawed person for life?
I think it absolutely is. And I kind of facetiously call this law and order SVU culture that we live in. We have this notion baked into our consciousness that there's something about sexual harm and people who commit it that is pathological, that people can't be rehabilitated, that they're sick in the head, that they're uniquely depraved, and that they're just going to keep offending and offending. And it's entirely not based in reality, but it's a very emotional reaction that people have. And it's a big task to push past that sort of instinctual revulsion that people have toward this population and say, what can we do that's evidence-based and humane? Because what we are doing now is not keeping anybody safe. And it's ruining lives.
I'm speaking with Kat Pecor, a public defender in New York City. Part of the idea of criminal punishment is that it's supposed to deter other people from committing the same crime. Is there any evidence that this kind of registry has that deterrent effect?
No, not at all. And in fact, one of the things that's unique about sexual offenses is that, I think I may have mentioned this, but most people who commit sexual harm are not going to get caught ever. It's statistically, it's difficult to successfully prosecute. Most people do not come forward and report. It's hard to hold people accountable. And then of the people who do make it into the criminal punishment system, a very small, tiny percentage of those people end up serving time. So if you think about it, deterrence needs to be something that's applied consistently and swiftly. And here we just have a tiny percentage of people bearing the entire burden of punishment for the rest of their lives. You know, people commit sex crimes because they think they will get away with it. They're not expecting to be caught. I think there's also an inverse deterrent effect because people are not going to come forward and take responsibility and take accountability for harm when they know that the cost to them is so high. And people who are victims, who don't want their family members sent to prison for life, who don't want their family members on the registry, homeless, banished, those people are not going to come forward and get the help that they need and speak about what happened because they don't want this type of perpetual punishment either for their friends and family. So it really, it actually has a perverse effect of discouraging reporting and preventing people from coming forward and being rehabilitated.
Now, the politics of this are curious because, you know, in some, a lot of crimes, people on the left would be kind of indulgent or forgiving or want to impose minimal punishment, if at all. But when it comes to sex crimes, a lot of people on the left get really moralizing and just as punitive as some right wing nut. Is that a fair perception?
I think that's absolutely fair. This is one of my biggest pet peeves. Obviously, you know, I'm a socialist, I'm a prison abolitionist, and I apply those principles very consistently. I don't think that we can carve out sex offenses because there's no evidence to support that. I really sort of blame carceral feminism, I guess, for this mentality. The idea that, okay, in the past, women and certain vulnerable groups, they weren't believed when they spoke about the sexual harm they experienced. And so we need to listen to them and we need to take them seriously. And that's absolutely true. But now the Me Too movement has kind of devolved into this very reactive notion of, well, we have to always believe survivors, but not only that, any type of due process or protection for people who commit harm is somehow an insult to survivors or somehow anti-feminist or anti-progressive, which is, I think this is where the message really got distorted.
And it seems like a lot of the, I've read several accounts of people who just didn't really understand what they were doing and they find themselves on this registry for life. I mean, is that also, how common is that?
So are you talking about people who don't understand their behavior is wrong or people who don't understand the legal consequences?
No, people who don't really understand their behavior is wrong because of some sort of handicap or mental illness.
Yeah, I've seen that a lot. I see that with juveniles. Something like 25% of people on the registry are there for conduct they committed as kids. And so we are pathologizing normal sexual exploration that kids engage in. If the kids have developmental disabilities or something like that, then it makes them even less culpable for whatever harm they may have committed. So we are throwing away people like trash for life when they are young, when they are immature, when their brains are not fully developed, sometimes when they're dealing with serious mental illness. And we're setting them up to fail by saying, hey, you have to jump through all these hoops and meet all these ridiculous requirements. And if you don't, we're going to charge you with a felony for failure to register and you're never going to get to go home again.
Are there any other crimes that are treated similarly that you just basically can't get it off your record for life?
If you committed a serious violent crime, that would be on your record. I know that some states do have registries for like gun crimes or I think even homicides. New York isn't one of them as far as I know. But it really is sexual offenses that kind of started the ball rolling. Now, yes, states are creating registries for other types of things, but I think that is all rooted in the mentality that gave us sex offender registries, that this is an epidemic that needs to be addressed in a serious way.
Of course, I'm sure some people are listening and saying, these are terrible crimes. What would you do? So what would you do?
What would I do? So the answer to that question is very similar to the question of what we would do with any other type of offense. So there's not anything particularly special about sex offenses. People commit them for the same variety of reasons that they commit a lot of other offenses. So poverty, lack of resources, trauma, you know, feelings of powerlessness in their lives. I would say toxic kind of patriarchal culture and, you know, access opportunity with an institution. So I think we have to address these offenses in the same way from an abolitionist perspective that we were addressing other types of offenses. So some examples would be, you know, education about healthy sexual boundaries, giving people the material resources they need to live their lives, institutional oversight, transformative justice processes, you know, within the community that allow offenders to get help and be rehabilitated and allow victims to feel heard and honored and heal. And, you know, rehabilitation really does work. the studies show that people who get treatment for quote unquote sex offender treatment, for whatever reason, that does seem to help people who have these more true pathologies for offending. Now, it may just be that they never had therapy before and anything would have helped them have a little better self-awareness. But the point is that these people are absolutely not beyond redemption. I see it every day with my clients and my work. They absolutely do spend decades out of prison, out of trouble. They live upstanding lives. They work. They have families. And they really just want to move forward. And so I think that we have to look at doing this in a sort of judgment-free, evidence-based way that takes into account the whole person, not just the offense. I think it's important to be precise and intentional with our language when we discuss these types of cases. So one of the things I learned when I started this work, before I knew anything about it, is that we don't say sex offenders. We use person first language, so it makes it a little awkward, but you might say people charged with or convicted of sex offenses, people on the registry, or even registrants. The idea being that we're trying to subvert the practice of putting the offense first. So that's one thing that I would encourage people to do if they have discussions about this issue.
You've touched on this some, but let's bring it more explicit. I'm sure there are a lot of people who think that there are offenders going around, serial rapists, serial sexual abusers. How common is that kind of serial crime?
Well, it's very uncommon. So like I said, the most sexual offenses are committed by people who are first-time offenders. They are not on the registry. So being on the registry does not predict future offending. It does not actually allow you to identify future offenders with any accuracy. And the recidivism rate for sex offenses, again, is really low. There's this notion that actually comes from a Supreme Court decision in 2002, where they said that the recidivism rate for sex offenders is, quote, frightening and high. Every subsequent court case has repeated that as though it's gospel truth. But the fact is that figure, that recidivism figure, which was estimated to be 80%, came from an article in Psychology Today written by a guy who was essentially advertising a sex offender treatment program that he was running. So he wanted people to think that they, you know, that this was a really dangerous situation and that these people really needed treatment. Again, the true recidivism rate is well below 5%. There is absolutely nothing to suggest that there's something special about this type of offense, that people will just offend and offend and offend over and over again.
Are there any jurisdictions trying the kinds of humane approaches you mentioned, or does the federal requirement make that impossible?
Because of the federal law, states pretty much are required to have registries. And I think that in order for us to change that, we have to change the federal system, which is a huge ask. However, one thing that we could change in New York, and that I'm hoping that I will eventually get to do some work on, is taking away the residency restrictions, because those are one of the biggest problems and obstacles facing my clients. There's definitely nothing in the federal law that says we have to have residency restrictions. New Jersey doesn't have them, and they don't have any higher incidence of sex offending than we do here. So there are ways we can minimize this sort of carceral net that we throw over everyone. But obviously, I think that we have to abolish the registry wholesale. Who knows if that'll happen in my lifetime? I can dream.
So when you make these kinds of arguments, do people look at you like you're a freak?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've had so many arguments online, which I really shouldn't be doing, with, you know, self-proclaimed communists and socialists who say, you know, oh, I'd really love to castrate a pedophile or throw him off a cliff or have him executed. And I don't know if they think they're being edgy or what, but it's a very common mentality. When I go into court and I argue these cases, the disgust in the room among all parties is palpable. You know, I feel it from the court. I feel it from obviously the prosecutor, anybody who's in the audience, the clerks. It's kind of this feeling of, who are you to come in here and stand up for this person? Who are you to defend this person's rights? And so, yes, it is a difficult position to be in, but I've always found myself drawn to helping the most reviled people in society, because I think they need the help. So I'm happy to do it.
This must be why you lift weights, to develop some body armor.
Yeah, I love a challenge. Oh, you know, it's also why I couldn't be a prosecutor, because they always win. And what fun is that? I mean, you know, I love a good uphill battle.
Well, yeah, anytime I met a prosecutor, most of the prosecutors I've met in life have been kind of unpleasant people with a very sour outlook on life and kind of mean people.
sex crimes prosecutors are kind of particularly bad because they really do think they're like the cast of SVU. They think they are doing God's work on earth and they are putting the bad guys away. And they really don't have any, you know, they won't even respond to my emails half the time. It's just like, I don't exist. So it's a difficult fight, but I love to do it. And I, you know, it's a very necessary fight.
Well, I guess by defending them, you're almost as bad as they are.
I do think that there's a sense of identifying the attorney with the client. I do think that there's a moral judgment there that's made, yes. And although that's true of public defenders writ large, I mean, I have heard myself referred to as a bad guy helper, which is what I do professionally.
So the right to counsel is one in name only.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you want me to talk at all about how the hearings work, but it may be too technical for this podcast, but I'll just say briefly, the idea in New York is that you have due process. You have an individualized risk assessment, which means that the court is looking at a rubric and scoring you according to your purported risk level. So that is, the courts have found that that is all the due process that is required to make this fair. And the court's going to give the DA the highest level they request and the Board of Examiners of Sex Offenders the highest level they request on the registry. And it is really often an exercise in futility. So yes, I would say there is due process formally, but not necessarily in practice.
That was Kat Bacor, a public defender in New York City. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of the Velvet Underground section of a new album by Deerhoof, Love Lore, which consists of covers of 42 songs by artists ranging from Ornette Coleman to Gary Numan, from Stockhausen to the Beach Boys. As a text accompanying the album puts it, Love Lore forages a wide-ranging selection of music from the 50s through the 80s to reflect upon the overly optimistic promises of progress that humanity was fed across the culture and music of the post-war era. Instead of the projected 21st century in which disease, racism, and inequality are obsolete, and everyone has a flying car and a robot maid, our current blasted landscape finds the men, women, and children of Earth at the brink of extermination. And at the same time, Deerhoof finds hope in the wisdom of some of that era's anti-establishment voices, particularly the Afrofuturists, whose seeds we now see beginning to grow into trees. Next, Chile, where we see some encouraging growth in the form of a referendum to write a new constitution. On October 25th, 78% of Chileans voted to scrap the old Pinochet-era constitution and write a new one from scratch. Given the antiquity of our constitution, the idea makes me jealous. And a similar amount voted to have a constitutional convention, not the existing legislature, write the new document. Here's Antonia Atria, a socialist and student activist in Chile, to explain. Apologies for the glitches in the audio. Zoom is a very imperfect medium. Antonia Atria. Were you surprised by the results of this referendum? Was the vote turnout kind of what you expected, or was it more in favor of rewriting than you thought?
I'm sort of an exception. The results were actually what I hoped. I bet on them and won. But most people here actually were really surprised, and they thought it was going to be a tighter race. They usually talked about higher than 65%, between 65 and 70%, but no one would be near 80%. That was a big surprise for most people. I did vote 78%, so I won my bets, but for most people, it was shocking. Participation was also sort of shocking in a weird way, because we did expect more participation. I mean, we did think it would be higher than 60%, but it still was the biggest voting turnout since the return of democracy. And I think we didn't consider the weight the pandemic would still have on voters and how people are still scared to go outside, and many did not go vote because of that same issue. However, it was still the biggest voting turnout we've had. More than half of the country went out to vote, and that's pretty impressive considering the crisis in representation we had. Our current president was elected with 40%, so it was a big turnout, I guess.
The protests started about a year ago, almost exactly a year ago.
Yeah.
And now we have this referendum, actually moved rather quickly given the normal pace of politics. What's happened over the last year to result in this? We certainly got out of coverage a year ago when people were burning metro stations, but what's happened over the last year that we probably paid much less attention to for the Northern Hemisphere? What kind of political organization, agitation, education has been going on?
Firstly, I think the pandemic was a big campaign sort of for the referendum, because the pandemic showed and made even more visible how the neoliberal system does not cover basic rights and needs. So people lost their job. The only answer this neoliberal government gave people was use your unemployment insurance. Even if you're not unemployed, we will allow to freeze your contracts if you're not going to work. And so you will not have your wages. And if you don't have that, well, use your unemployment insurance, which does not cover informal workers or domestic workers in the sense of housekeepers and stuff. Health, it was still a big issue. People got in big, big debts for treatments. And well, now with the pandemic, a lot of people needed treatments and they couldn't afford them. So education, people, for example, with higher education, they don't have the means to pay their going to college. And there was no answer to that. And so it became very, very clear we're in a big problem, not only what has been carried for more than 30 years, but also right now, there are a lot of issues that the current constitution would not allow to solve. And the other thing that happened was that, well, we do have a social security system that's private. It's called IFPs. Basically, you give a certain percentage of your income every month, and then you have your own individual fund, and that individual fund is what you will live off when you're old. So each person looks after themselves. There's no solidarity. There's a small solidarity pillar. Obviously, it's not enough. What we had was this thing of taking out the 10% of your savings in your IFPs. And that was huge. Every time we had tried to do anything to IFPs, touch a single hair on their heads, right-wing politicians just shut it down. Because IFPs are the root of our capitalistic system. They sustain a lot of the ways we can see social security, a lot of ways that social security is understood and the state's role in welfare is understood. And so being able to pass a law that allowed people to take out 10% of their savings was a big issue, because it told them, this is your money, not the IFPs money to do whatever they want with it. And this is not a social security system. This is just a savings account. Take out your money, because right now we need it because we're in a crisis. And then when we change the constitution, we can make a system that actually considers solidarity as its main point, as a system that is actually social security and not individual security, so to speak. That also made it evident that IFPs would not be touched this with this constitution unless you have like a big crisis and a big pandemic and everything. And so that also showed people that they're uniting, they're organizing, contributes to materialized change. So seeing that win, that economical win because people could go to the supermarket again. They could buy food. They could pay off bills. 40% of debts for medical treatment were paid because people take out that money. So having that victory kind of showed them that what we can accomplish with the referendum is real, and it has real impact in your life.
Talk some about that constitution. It was a neoliberal ideal, yeah. Right? Like Friedrich Hayek could have written it. It was talk about the constitution. What kind of things did it limit, make impossible?
Well, for example, a very clear example is with the right to the access of health. You don't have in any part of the constitution written that we have access to health, that the state.
Neither do we, for that matter.
Oh, you don't?
No.
Well, we have, the only reference we have is that we have the freedom to choose into a public or a private healthcare system. That's what our constitution guarantees. And that is a very good example of the logic with which the constitution was written. So basically what it does is it gives the role the state of a subsidiary state, but in terms of the state will cover only what the market cannot cover. So if you are not competitive enough, if you can't pay the most expensive schools, or you can't pay any school because you're actually poor, well, you will have a shitty public education free, but frankly, not even to the heels of the private education and the expensive education. And so basically what it allows is it makes our rights something for which people can make businesses from, which people can enrich from. And it gives the state's role only to make sure that you have the access to the bare minimum.
What does this process going to look like over the coming months? I mean, the voters chose to have an elected assembly write the constitution, right? Not the current Congress.
Yeah, we had the constitutional assembly. We call it convention. I think it's very American to speak on those terms. but yeah, we have a 100% elected constituent assembly. And well, what comes now is we have the discussion about how and what we imagine that convention having as their rule book, so to speak. So we do have a 2/3 quorum for decision making. So you need to have 2/3 of the assembly to pass anything you want on the constitution. So we need to add more things to that. Like, does it have any link to territorial organizations? Will there be any system of making it more representative or more participative, the work of the convention? So all those discussions are coming now. Another big discussion that we have to face from today onwards is the discussion about political alliances. Are we going to go, as the left always goes, separated in 15 different lists, making it virtually impossible for us to get the 2/3 we need for any agreement? Or are we going to go in one single list together in a unity list, or things in between, like two lists of candidates and stuff? Those are the two big discussions that we have coming up. And then when the election starts, I hope the demonstrations and protests will still have to sort of channel that process towards what we really want.
I'm speaking with Antonia Atria, a socialist and student activist in Chile. Now, of course, Pinochet destroyed the left. What does the political configuration look like now? Are there organizations on the left? And what about consciousness too? You mentioned like everything about the constitution was designed to destroy any notion of solidarity. Has solidarity managed to survive and recover from that? Or yeah, what's the state of consciousness and organization right now?
First, about the political spectrum look like. We have a very united right wing. The only time I've seen them have a fragmentation was right now when not all of them for the reject option on the do you want a new constitution. Some of the right wings did campaign for the yes, we want a new constitution option, but besides that, they have a history of being very united and work like a block, so it's very hard to breed tensions between them. And at the left, we have center left, which are really, well, I guess it's very similar to your situation. We have center-left parties that are basically right-wing parties. They have maintained this neoliberal system. They have never made actual attempts to change it. And I think that is because the democratic way that we got out of the dictatorship sort of made the distinction between right and left based on whether you are a Democrat or you are pro-Pinochet. And so everyone that was for democracy was turned to this left, but that left us with a lot of people that support this neoliberal system. However, they just didn't like the way they didn't like the dictatorship, which is a very minimum thing to do. So we have that tension within the left because we have this sort of right-wing left. And then we have this new force called the White Front, which I'm a part of, which is a series of smaller parties. One of us is a big party, which is Revolución Democrática, Democratic Revolution. And this is like the new force. When I look at US politics, I feel like DSA or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are very similar to what we're trying to do. Like, we face this establishment, which has a left wing and a right wing, which a left wing is a bit really like a right wing, like a soft right wing. And so this new force sort of tries to come in and speak about real left, like socialism and democratic socialism. Those are the three big political forces. With the question about organization, consciousness, and solidarity, I would say that after October 18th, when the estallido social, as we've called it, things have been different. You see people more willing to collaborate with you, and you see people taking care of each other, and you see also how the community has been able to face problems that does not solve. So for example, during this pandemic too, we had a big problem with domestic violence. So we were quarantined, and many women were living with husbands that were their aggressors. And the state, the ministry of the women's ministry did nothing, amazingly. And the only answer was territorial organization, neighbors that lent a hand to women that needed it, neighbors that sort of organized to help them. Or with the crisis of food, we had a very big unemployment rate. And the answer was local, how do you call it? Common pots, I guess would be the translation, which is a big pot where women from neighborhoods cook for the entire neighborhood. And so they eat together, and they went through that rough time of not being able to afford food by all together pitching in and making this communal places where you ate. So there has been a change, and you can see people working together to face their problems and organizing, and with a very, very clear political end and what they want. The legacy of the dictatorship is starting to leave and disappear, I hope.
People up here sometimes are just describing the outcome of the referendum as a victory for the left. Is it that, or is it just that kind of centrist democracy that you're talking about with the mainstream parties?
I think it was a victory for the left, because I think the system that the right wing has proposed, the neoliberal system, is done for. People do not want it. They understand that it's not thought to benefit all of us. It's just thought to benefit the small 1% that has the big money in their pocket. So what we now have is this dignity that the left, or the real left, so to speak, has been trying to push for decades now. So yeah, I don't think people do recognize, I am from the left, and that's why I'm voting apruebo. I do want a new constitution. But it is a victory of the ideas that the left has pushed. And the reason why people don't recognize themselves as left or right is because right now we're in a political crisis where people do not feel represented by political parties. They refer their critics to politicians as the whole. And that is because politicians have not done anything to change this institution, the institutions we have. They have had massive mobilizations for years, and never, not once, had that translated into a big change. The protests from 2011 with the educational system did not result in anything more than a need-based gratuity system that left universities in deep debt that was not thought for everyone, and it's based on excellency, which is basically a very neoliberal way of guaranteeing free higher education. So that makes them see the distinction between left and right as a distinction of politicians. And since we don't like politicians, we do not fit into those categories. And that's why they don't recognize themselves as left. And some people may say it's not a left victory, but I think it's the ideas the real left has been speaking about for years and decades. And it's a way of demanding things, of organizing, of protesting. That is just what the left has been trying to do for decades too. So of course it's a victory for the left, even though people don't give it that label.
And coming at the same time, more or less, as the Bolivian election, some people are saying maybe the pink tide isn't dead after all. What do you think about that?
It is a process of reparation in Latin America. We're starting a process of reparation with the triumph of Alberto Fernández in Argentina, the triumph of Mas in Bolivia. What we have is people saying we have gone through a wave of right-wing politicians. They were supposed to have this this coup, basically. They did a coup from the right wing, saying that people did not want what Evo Morales was doing anymore. And I think what the Bolivians showed is that they do trust this process, that they do trust what Evo Morales started and what others will now continue doing, and that they are not disenchanted with that way of thinking, politics, and the political agenda. They are not against what the left-wing party has done, which is very good, because every time we try to push any left thing, any left proposals here, the typical argument, the annoying argument, is that we're basically going to turn into Venezuela, and that we're basically trying to make a dictatorship like the one Maduro has, whatever. And so I think these other processes like Bolivia show us that it doesn't turn out that way, that we can make changes and still have the support of the people, which is the really important thing, and that people trust this sort of processes. And that's why Bolivia, I think, is a very good example and something that we can stand for the proposals we will do from now on.
All right. Well, thank you and good luck.
We have never been more proud of being from Chile than right now, and seeing this historical moment has been heartwarming for many of us.
That was Antonio Atria, a socialist and student activist in Chile. Pinochet's constitution was a paradigmatic neoliberal document. It was intended to insulate the economic realm from certain kinds of political influence. For some of the intellectual background behind it, here's a bit of my January 2019 interview with the historian Quinn Slobodian, author of Globalists. Well, they were concerned about the gravediggers that Marx wrote about, that you know, collectivism was on the march, and their view of the world was under siege, and they were quite consciously founded as a group to fight those tendencies, to plot over the longer term. I mean, I don't want to sound conspiratorial, but they were, to some degree, conspiring to defend this social system that they loved, especially in retrospect. They had a nostalgia for a pre-World War I world, which many of them grew up in. It may not be a conspiracy to destroy the working class, but it was something of the order to limit its power.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Jamie Peck has this great line where he says, you know, there's conspiracy theories and there's conspiracy facts. And it is certainly true that when these people, Hayek and Rupka and Mises, first got together in the 1930s, they saw the danger being sort of on the left and the right. So for sure, the fear of communism, for sure, asterisk, we could talk about it more, a concern about fascism. But the real fear was the one that outlasted the Second World War, which was the fear of social democracy, right? This idea of a kind of a Keynesian fix for capitalism's contradictions that could draw in people and sort of create a peace between workers and capitalists. And this is what they saw as being, coming out of the Second World War, the real danger. The soft left, actually, was the danger, not the hard left or the right.
But they're also terrified of planning, whether we're talking about Soviet style or more Keynesian, softer style.
Mm-hmm. Yep, planning was a concern. But it's interesting. I mean, Hayek even goes out of his way to destigmatize that word, by saying that, you know, in a way, we don't want to trash the idea of planning per se, because everyone makes plans in the sense that they operate on expectations about the future. So every entrepreneur does that. People do that. So they were actually pretty specific about what kind of planning they disliked. And obviously, it was the model of nationalization and creating kind of targets for outputs of industries that were owned by the state, of the kind that was being done by the Soviet Union, yes, but also the UK and France after the Second World War.
They did not believe that capitalism was a spontaneous order in itself. They certainly loved spontaneity within the capitalist order that they had been setting up, but they believed it required institutions and rules to guide it. And this whole idea that they're all about getting the state out is exactly wrong.
Yes, I mean, that's sort of the biggest intervention, I guess, that I'm making in the book. I'm not the first one to make it, but there's a way in which critics of neoliberalism kind of get hoodwinked by the language of neoliberals themselves. So the sort of standard criticism of neoliberalism is, what an outrageous philosophy. There can't be any such thing as a self-regulating market. These people are obviously fools. But if you even read 10 pages of neoliberal theory, whether it's Buchanan or Hayek or Friedman, you see that they actually see the necessity of the state everywhere. Neoliberalism as a philosophy, and then certainly as a kind of a practice of government, is always about re-engineering and retrofitting the state to better protect what they see as the space of competition and free enterprise, rather than doing away with the state altogether. And the idea of the self-regulating market, yes, it was in Smith to some extent, but that term really gets popularized by Karl Polanyi, who is a big critic, of course, of liberalism and a critic of some of these Austrians like Hayek and Mises. People often take Polanyi's language as being reflective of what the neoliberals actually thought, whereas what I argue in the book is that people like Hayek and Mises were actually contemporaries of Polanyi in the sense that they all agreed that there wasn't such a thing as a self-regulating market, and that there had to be a kind of a legal encasement of the space of the market for it to function. They just had different politics inside of that conception.
That was Quinn Slobodian, who teaches history at Wellesley, from a January 2019 interview. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, the Eddie Grant cover from the new Deerhoof album. Till next week, bye.